Welcome to On Trial, starring Mark Ratledge, also starring Sean Comer. Hope you're ready, Hollywood, because you're on trial.
All rise. Court is now in session. The Honorable Vincent Kennedy McMahon presiding. This is On Trial. And I promise you no one's getting dumped in a garbage truck tonight. I'm your host and defense attorney for this evening's proceedings, Mr. Mark Ratledge, your mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified. And on the docket tonight, because we are concluding our week-long trip through wrestling reviews and celebrating WrestleMania, because WrestleMania just happened this past weekend, No Holds Barred from 1989, starring the immortal Hulk Hogan. And prosecuting this turkey is the one and only Sean Comer. You are not. How the hell are you, Sean?
Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we reminisce on that time when a charismatic, conniving cable magnate sought to lure Hulk Hogan away from the World Wrestling Federation in order to front his fledgling competing company of graps. No, the other time. The one when Hogan ultimately ended up main eventing a show with Tiny Lister. No, the other time. The other time. Yeah, that one.
Yeah, Hulk Hogan, you know, he gave the... he left... I mean, Pat would know better. Pat's my wrestling historian. But if I remember correctly, didn't he leave after dropping the belt to Warrior to go do this?
Shit, son. You don't need Pat for this. No, as a matter of fact, he dropped the belt to Warrior in 1990.
Oh, that's right.
At WrestleMania 6. This was actually sometime circa WrestleMania 5.
Oh, when did he have time?
See, that's what I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to remember when he did it, because I could be wrong, and I cannot summon the urge to go call WrestleMania 5 up on Peacock and check this, but I do believe I faintly remember hearing this plugged during WrestleMania 5.
Yeah, it was 5.
Yeah, well, and Anne, who I have been introducing to professional wrestling, just backed me up that she's pretty sure it's WrestleMania 5. Which makes even less sense, because who goes and makes a movie right before they're about to carry the WWF championship for a whole year again?
Yeah, and there are, look at the Wikipedia page for this, there are absolutely no production notes. None. Zero.
No. I told you that straight up before the show.
Plot, box office, period.
Yeah, and like I said, tonight we are not so much coming at this as movie critics. We are coming at this as connoisseurs of big, meaty men slapping meat.
Yeah, I was 12. This actually came out on June 2nd, 1989, and that was my 12th birthday, and this is what I wanted to do for my 12th birthday. It was me and a handful of my buddies, all dudes, because of course, and my dad took a car full of us to go see this against his will and better judgment, and not a fan of wrestling. This was the guy who the first time he saw Randy Savage drop an elbow said, you know, if a guy really landed an elbow on you like that, he'd kill you, and then proceeded to saunter out of the room. Like, all right. So that's what I grew up with.
Well, yeah. Whereas on the other hand, many moons later, one of the two of them, you know, you make the call which one, had the bright idea during a match that with Hogan down, all Randy would have to do to summon a mighty tidal wave of Hulkamania would be to run up to the top rope and drop the big elbow on his own tag partner.
So this is what we did, and we went to the movie, and I remember as a kid I loved it, because what did I know? But we all did. We all had a fun time with it. I mean, you know, Hulk Hogan, I was thinking about this today. When I was trying to frame this movie in my head and think about, like, what it was I wanted to talk about, you know, besides the film craft, I was thinking about Sylvester Stallone and the big, meaty superhero action heroes that he played during that time. You know, your Rambos and your Rockies and your Cobras and your Tangos and Cash, and I might have my timeline a little messed up there, but, you know, like, Stallone and Schwarzenegger were your two muscly action heroes. You know, you had Schwarzenegger with Conan and Terminator and Commando around this time, and then later, you know, The Running Man and Total Recall and all that. And then, like I said, the aforementioned Stallone. And Hulk Hogan, who has a little bit of an ego, just a smidgen.
This is a tease. It's a little bit.
Yeah. He had to look at those two, look at himself and said, why not me? What do they got that I ain't got? I mean, he's delusional, but I really feel like that's what he thought. And when you look at what No Holds Barred is, I don't want to get too much into my defense, but just sort of in a general way, No Holds Barred is Hulk Hogan thinking, this is going to be my ticket to Stallone and Schwarzenegger-type action movies. That's what this was supposed to be. I mean, watching it back, it's laughably not, but...
come on. Everything you just described is exactly why Hogan and Vince were both such a formidable creative force for so many years, and ultimately why they eventually turned on each other.
Yeah.
Is because they're too alike to ever coexist. Vince McMahon has always come across like he's absolutely ashamed that he has never been better at anything. He has been at promoting professional wrestling.
110% agree with you.
Yeah, he has always tried to branch into something else.
Yep.
And been absolutely roundly laughed out of the room.
Yeah,
by the major players.
So many abject failures. I think he tried to promote boxing and that went nowhere. He started a bodybuilding league and that failed. You know, famously, the XFL tanked after one season.
Remember when he had the brilliant idea that he was going to do a line of WWE-oriented novels where all of the wrestlers were secretly secret agents?
I actually don't remember that.
It was like a 2 or 3 book series. It came out right around the same time as that whole fictionalized novel. That retconned about 90% of Kane's backstory.
Oh yeah, that's the one everyone talks about.
Oh well, yeah, but I mean, I think there were only 2 of them actually published. But I shit you not, these books are out there. My buddy Jeremy actually owned at least one of them. I know he did. Because the ones I remember most are like. It's centered on, I think, Torrey Wilson and Chavo Guerrero. And, you know, then he years, many moons after this, in about the mid-2000s, he crafts WWE Studios. So he can put out one shitty Z-grade movie after another starring at least one WWE superstar.
In his defense, the ice cream bars worked out well.
You know. You know.
he had one hit out of a dozen failures.
I mean, shit, they even had, like... You remember back during the Ruthless Aggression era? When there was a different shitty new metal band that was, you know, that generously provided the theme song?
Sure.
To each and every pay-per-view.
That was one of like Saliva's big gets.
Yeah.
Click, click, boom, baby.
They had like, and it's even in the credits at the end of each WWE video game. There was a company called Stephanie Music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So to round this back to where I started, like Hulk Hogan. I don't know how much input he had on the production of this thing. Again, it's hard to know. It's hard to guess. But I absolutely think preceding this, looking at his run from, you know, 84 to 89, 88, you know, he has to be looking at himself like, I'm bigger than wrestling. I'm better than wrestling. I can go on and be an action hero, bigger than even Schwarzenegger or Stallone. And this is going to be my ticket.
God. I'll tell you what.
It's fun to think about the movie in that frame. You know what I mean? Because it's like, who in the middle of making all this, who in the middle of acting in it, thought this thing was going to take the world by storm?
Well, you know, let me tell you something, Gene Mean. I don't know how down you are to kind of call this episode in the ring, so to speak. But I got a proposition for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm throwing myself on the shield right here, or throwing myself on my sword rather, on the shield. Yeah, power bomb me to hell, baby. Just an admitting, I can't bring myself to legitimately criticize this. It's too fucking stupid for me to sit here and even pretend to be an actual critic. So I'm actually suggesting, why don't we just ditch the usual prosecution defense format and just riff a little bit lovingly.
Oh, this is going to be our first plea bargain.
You know what? I'm down for it, because it's so bad. Again, it's so much easier when I'm watching something that's just appallingly terrible. That's just it's such an absolute crime against trying to be a serious filmmaker. I might as well be trying to riff Monstered or Deathbed, the bed that eats people.
Oh, hello, Pat Oswald.
or fucking Teeth. I can't do it. So yes, let's just have some fun with this.
I'm fine with that, but for the sake of just telling people who might be listening to this who may have never actually seen this thing before, Rip Thomas is the World Wrestling Federation heavyweight champion, and his appearances on network television have been a thorn in the side of Mr. Brell, who's played by Kurt Fuller, I haven't seen a man hump the scenery since Denzel Washington in Training Day. Holy cow!
Oh my god.
The head of the struggling World Television Network. These names start starting to remind me of Rob Zombie albums. Rip is a huge ratings draw, while WTN is the lowest rated television network. The day after Rip's most recent title match, Brell attempts to get Rip to become part of his network, but he refuses. Angry at being stood up by a man he considers and will say a zillion times throughout this 93-minute movie, a jockass. I don't know what copy of this you were able to pirate, but I had to find a modulated copy on YouTube with the sound all messed up
because
it's been scrubbed from everywhere.
We watched the same version.
Okay, with it, yes. It's in the little box. Okay, every time he said jockass, I'm like, is he saying jackass and it's just messed up the sound?
Because he fucking sounds like Cartman.
Right. Brell tries to exact revenge to no avail as Rip fights off his goons. Later, Brell visits the No Count Bar, where he comes up in his own wrestling program called the Battle of the Tough Guys, because this was written by a 10-year-old. The show is successful due to the introduction of Zeus, played by the late Tiny Lister Jr., an ex-convict and former protege of Rip's trainer, Charlie. Zeus wins the $100,000 tournament and becomes Brell's prized fighter. Samantha Moore, played by Joan Severance, or at least she tries, a corporate spy, is sent by Brell to seduce Rip. However, Rip's good nature and dedication to charity win her over, and she confesses her identity to the wrestler and turns to his side like you do. Brell learns of Samantha's defection and, vowing revenge, sends his underlings to kidnap and rape her. Sure! Rip stops the would-be kidnapping, throwing one of the stooges into a tree trunk. Later, Rip is at a charity event when Brell and Zeus arrive, demanding that Rip prove his honor by fighting Zeus on the Battle of the Tough Guys. Rip, wanting to set a good example and knowing children are around, declines. Meanwhile, Rip's younger brother, Randy, and his friend, Craig, Randy played by a mannequin, decide to check out Zeus for themselves, attending an illegal fight being held in a warehouse. After watching Zeus defeat the monstrous Rebar Lawless, sure, Craig identifies Randy as Rip's brother, Dubrell, and his associates. Randy attempts to defend himself, but Zeus brutally beats him, sending him to the hospital. Enraged, Rip accepts Zeus's challenge to avenge his brother. On the night of the match, Brell has Samantha kidnapped again and orders Rip to go 10 minutes through the fight, then lose the fight to save her. As the battle begins, Samantha escapes, but just as Brell's goons corner her, Charlie and Craig rescue her and defeat the bad guys. Back in the arena, Zeus has the upper hand at the start of the fight, ruthlessly pummeling Rip, even trying to kill him by ripping out one of the steel posts and trying to run Rip through his prone chest. Randy cheers to urge his brother to fight back. Rip is re-energized, hulks up by Randy's words, and once he sees Samantha is safe, gains a second win and starts to turn the tide on Zeus. The fight destroys the ring, with Rip and Zeus continuing to battle up through the stands as Brell watches from the control room. Rip finally puts an end to the match by knocking Zeus off a catwalk, which causes him to fall through the ring and lose, a la Bam Bam Bigelow. A frustrated Brell begins destroying electrical equipment. Enraged over Zeus's loss, Rip angrily goes after Brell, intending to repay him for his misdeeds. In fear, Brell retreats, but accidentally comes in contact with live wires he has exposed in his tirade and is electrocuted. With their enemies vanquished, Rip and Randy celebrate victory with friends. And it was at that moment when I saw him get electrocuted, I was like, holy cow, this is a live-action Disney cartoon. The villain literally gets killed in the end.
So, we have death by electrocution, attempted rape, a Richard Belzer lookalike shitting himself.
Dookie! What's that smell?
We have domestic violence. We have that poor blonde mannequin being crippled for life. Who was this movie made for?
Like I said, I gotta look it up real quick, but I feel like somebody watched Cobra and was like, we can make something at least that good. And here's the thing, not with this group you couldn't.
Lest I forget, Stan Lane drunkenly and loudly judging the size of a yuppie's penis.
So this was directed by Thomas J. Wright, who has directed episodes of Smallville, One Tree Hill, and Firefly.
this guy contributed to Firefly.
This gets better though, because he started off with Torchlight, then he directed the 1986 Twilight Zone movie, then he went on to acclaim with Max Headroom. All my 80s friends out there, mid 40 year olds, you remember Max Headroom? Because I do.
I remember Max Headroom.
Yeah, well, apparently he had a movie in 1987, and that led to this feature, No Holds Barred, which was then followed up in short order by Hell Hath No Fury, The X-Files in 1993, Nowhere Man, Millennium, Firefly, Taken, like that Taken? No, this is Steven Spielberg. CSI, Smallville, NCSI, Bones.
Are you serious? Wait, like, are we talking like Snoop Dogg Bones or Zooey Deschanel and David Boreanaz Bones?
Emily Deschanel,
right.
Yep.
You know, for a career that includes No Holds Barred, that is shockingly more hits than misses.
Yeah, I really like was expecting to see more. Sharknado or some shit on here.
Yeah, I'm over here cracking wise comparing this thing to Monstered, and now like I'm having to peel my eyebrows down from the top of my forehead, going, "Really? He had a hand in that?
Yeah, well,
I actually liked that."
Don't beat yourself too much, because the guy who wrote this thing has no Wikipedia page at all, no link, no nothing. I have no idea who Dennis Hacken is. But I'll tell you what, Tiny Lister, I think this might have been like one of his first major breakout roles. I know like what people will know him for is Friday, and kind of Friday, showing up in different places. Kind, you know, whenever you need a big, funny looking African American big fella, he usually showed up, usually for one liners and stuff, or he stood in the background and beat somebody up. He clearly was not a leading man. But Kurt Fuller, man, he's in everything. Kurt Fuller has had a long career in Hollywood and can actually act. I'm not sure what he was doing here.
Oh, no. He's one of the preeminent, for that time anyway, guy who was in that thing was also in that other thing.
Yeah.
The one I remember him most for is being the lackey to Rob Lowe's slimy cable executive in Wayne's World.
Mm-hmm.
The one that Garth has to talk down by informing him that if his friend were ice cream, he would be pralines and dick.
He'll follow this up with Ghostbusters 2.
That's true. He was in Ghostbusters 2.
Hey, this does not hurt his career, man. He is in plenty of shit after this.
No.
I think the most recent thing he did film-wise was Office Uprising in 2018. He's done a bunch of stuff before that. He did a lot of like shit comedies, like, you know, like the Scary Movie, superhero movie, that sort of thing. He was in Anger Management, which I absolutely hated, by the way. It's one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Oh, did that disappoint me?
Oh my God, he's in The Pursuit of Happiness. Haunt is right. And then he's done a shitload of television. Apparently he's been on a show called Evil. That's on CBS. And he's been on that since 2019. Before that, he was on Heather's, Law & Order Special Victims Unit for a couple episodes, and Shooter for a couple of episodes. So,
you know, there are some guys that are able to just kind of hit that pitch-perfect mark with the character. You know, your really thoughtful guys, like your Daniel Day-Lewis types, or your Robert De Niro's, your Bryan Cranston's. And then you have those guys, like, on one part of the spectrum, you've got like a Kurt Fuller, but on another guy I actually think of as Al Pacino, where it's almost like they can take a part and dial up the energy to what you figure they have to be thinking is like just over the top nonsense, just an explosion of excess and hammery.
Yeah, I was gonna say he had to have been handed this script and was like, and in his mind going, I can't believe they want me to do this. Well, okay, if I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna lean into it.
But here's the thing: they channel that kind of charisma, that kind of manic energy into something.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up being just right.
Yeah. Kurt Fuller's hilarious in this. Like, he's every bit a ridiculous, over-the-top, mustache-twirly Disney villain as he needs to be. But he's hilariously entertaining. And that's the thing. The charm of this movie is that once you realize it's not Cobra, once you realize it's not Commando, it's not even close, And you're like, okay, I'm not going to get the thrill out of this that I would from an 80s action movie. But if you just let yourself be entertained by it, it's incredibly entertaining. It's hilarious. It's one of those riff tracks kind of movies where this thing is made to be sit and watched among friends and laughed at uproariously. From the acting to the plot to the choreographed fighting, it's all so bad and so stupid, but it's wildly entertaining. It's the best. It's the best shit movie I've ever seen.
Well, you know, as long as we keep making the comparisons to Schwarzenegger and Stallone, my kind of reading of this is like this: when it comes to Stallone's appeal, he's your every guy.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from his kind of gruff mumble delivery to kind of the rough-hewn pugilist features, He's your guy if you truly want an everyman that you can't help but get behind. Schwarzenegger ruled with presence and charisma.
Yeah,
a combination of that ability to just naturally dominate any setting that you put him in, and to just effortlessly be this imposing physical force of nature. But at the same time, you hand him the right script, something like a Twins or a Kindergarten Cop or Jingle All the Way.
Mm-hmm.
And that natural charisma that he oozes, that infectious likability that draws people to him, it just floods out of his pores. So there you have that?
They have inverted careers, Stallone and Schwarzenegger, because Schwarzenegger is kind of a body, and he's used very much as, like you said, a presence early on in his film career, and over time he learns to act, and then he, like, you know, like a Jim Carrey or an Adam Sandler, but in reverse. He's like, okay, I've been doing these big-time action movies, and I'm learning to act as I go, and I'm getting better and better as the years go on, at least to one degree or another. I need to stretch my limbs. I need to challenge myself. And he starts doing comedies. And they weren't all hits. There's a, you know, for every Kindergarten Cop, there's a Junior. But you're right, Twins was like the big crossover breakout comedy hit for him, because he was opposite Danny DeVito, which helps a lot. Stallone was always a good actor. Stallone starts off as a dramatic actor. I mean, like Rocky, everyone knows for the boxing, but if you've actually sat and we have, because we did A Long Road to Ruin 100 years ago, but if you ever just like sit down and watch Rocky, you sit down and watch like his early non-action oriented like dramas that he did, like Stallone is absolutely a great actor. But as his career started to go, he kind of does the Schwarzenegger thing too, only it doesn't really work out for him, because he starts doing comedies, and it's like don't stop on my mom will shoot an Oscar, which is like a notorious bomb, like not on the level of Catwoman or anything, but it's up there. And, you know, so it's like, well, Schwarzenegger was able to make that leap, Stallone not so much.
Well, I mean, when it comes to Schwarzenegger, his arc, his career arc, yeah, that could also describe John Cena and The Rock, quite frankly. But, I mean, when it comes to Hogan, one thing this movie makes abundantly apparent is that he was a great fit for it, because all he had to do was go out there and be just an ever so slightly tweaked version of the guy that was already winning over the hearts and minds of Hulkamaniacs all over the world. He just had to go and do that with a camera pointed at him and very specific things that he was supposed to say and things that he was supposed to do at very particular times.
The one thing about it, though, and you get that when you watch this movie, is when he's doing action stuff and when he has to be an over-the-top wrestler, he's fine. He's Hulk Hogan. That, you know, we talked about this actually on the Mania of WrestleMania. I don't know if there's a guy in modern wrestling, in modern being from the mid-80s till now, that knew more what to do in that ring and when to do it than Hulk Hogan.
That was absolutely his gift. I wouldn't venture so far as to say he was the most creative guy in the world as far as coming up with really innovative, thoughtful things to do in his matches or with his character that maybe nobody would expect. But yeah, when it comes to his timing, it's something that I've been introducing Anne for about a year to professional wrestling, and she's not a Hogan fan. If anything, she's gravitated more towards NXT, the indie stuff on the network, the NWA, but really doesn't like Hogan. And one of the things that I really had to explain about him was twofold. Was I said, number one, Hogan, and they're kind of related, Hogan in America got over because he kind of knew how to get away with the bare minimum. And he kind of realized, okay, I don't really have to do all that much when I can just do this, and it's going to go over like gangbusters. Whereas on the other hand, historically, when he was over in Japan, he could adapt, and, you know, don't get me wrong, if you've never seen it, he still wasn't Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat, or Luke Fez, but he recognized that the American shtick wasn't going to hack it. Mm-hmm. And he was going to have to, and he was actually going to have to really work a little bit harder. But even when he was working the stereotypical WWF style matches over here, if you really go back and watch a lot of his main event stuff during his run, no matter who he was working with, yeah, like you said, it was like clockwork. He always had a feel for the crowd, and when he and whoever he was in there with just had him eating out of the palm of their hands, it was something he really kind of lost later in his career. I don't feel like he ever quite had it to that extent during his NWO run, but again, I think he recognized that he didn't need to.
You know, and that's the thing, and none of that translated to movies for him. None of that. I mean, like, as hard as he tried,
no.
he tried to do Knight Rider on a boat. You know, this isn't the only movie he's done. He's done Santa with Muscles, notoriously. He's done Mr. Nanny. That's the one everyone points to. Suburban Commando that had the Undertaker in it. And it's like he could not figure out how to translate what he did so naturally as a wrestler to being an actor, with the way others have. You know, The Rock, you know, you brought him up before, and he starts with big time action movies, and he can't act either. but he, and, you know, and he struggles. Like, when, you know, those, even though the rundown is great and Walking Tall is okay, like, he's really struggling in the beginning to figure out where he fits in. And he starts doing, like, family comedies. And John Cena kind of does the same thing, because he starts off with the action movies, too, because they all do, you know, because they're big, muscly men, and none of them can act. And then they all realize, hey, wait a minute, no, kids don't care if I can't act. I'll start doing that, and I'll get popular with kids, and I'll learn over time. And that's how the two of them became successful. They literally did the same thing. The Rock, you know, the one, the football movie he did with the kid, for Disney.
Oh, God, I'm trying... God damn, the Tooth Fairy.
Nope, that's the hockey one, and that followed it, and it wasn't nearly as successful.
Wait. I am just about... Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right.
I'm looking at it now.
Shit.
Oh, shit. Everyone's like, well, I know what this... The Game Plan.
I was actually... See, you said The Game Plan, and here I was getting my football movies mixed up. Mm-hmm. Because at first I went, Gridiron Gang? No, that was the inspirational drama that he did.
Right.
The Blind Side? No, that was Sandra Bullock. Shit.
But anyway, so, like, yeah, him and John Cena both kind of figured out how they were going to make it in Hollywood kind of the same way, and they followed the same sort of trajectory. I mean, for a while there, all John Cena did was Nickelodeon stuff. And it made, you know, it made him a household name. Kids love him.
There's just something hilarious about watching a big, muscle-bound Goliath being kind of clumsy and oafish and hapless and being, you know, outwitted by littles.
So, getting back to this movie, yeah, I mean... When Hogan has to act, it all kind of crumbles around him, and he's not supported by... Like, Joan Severance is a pretty lady, and she tries. She gives an earnest enough performance. It's a little hard to tell when her voice sounds like a chipmunk. But she, like I said, she's pretty enough lady. I mean, she's been in stuff. Stuff that's not anything people have heard of. But she was in Payback, which was a movie from 1995. She was in Bird on a Wire.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do remember her being a bit of a mid-tier name in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, she's had steady work in film from 87 to 2016. So she was a working actress. She's just not in a lot of high-profile stuff. I mean, you know, she had it from 98 to 99. She had a series, The Love Boat, The Next Wave. So she's in stuff here and there. And she does okay with this. I just, like I said, I think her and, you know, and some of the other actors in this are just not giving her a tremendous amount to work with. I mean, this is everyone kind of gather around Hogan and make him look like an action star. But it's one of those sort of, like, spectrum-y type films where they're all trying to make an action movie, but they don't quite seem to know how they work. They're like, oh, I've watched action... It's like the person who says, action movies are easy to make. I know how to do those. You just throw a bunch of fight scenes and stunts in them. And it's like, nope, movies involve characters with motivations.
You know what? Here's the thing to remember. It's really easy to make a bad action movie.
Yeah.
For exactly that very reason. But the thing is, think about it. Think about... When you think about action movies as a whole, you really have to reach sometimes to come up with 10, whereby any metric, they're not just great action movies, they're great movies.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to really try, and by try I mean let's set the rule of you can't name more than one movie per franchise. So let's see, off the top of my head, Alien. We'll count that one.
Alien or Aliens?
You know, I think you could count either. I think you could count either.
I would not count Alien as an action movie.
Okay, Aliens. Okay, then Aliens.
Sure.
I would count Aliens. That would be our one for the franchise. The Matrix. I would throw that in there. Terminator 2. The first RoboCop. The first Rambo. So there we go. We're up to 5. You could really... Yeah, the first John Wick. I would throw that in there. But then once you start to get around 5 or 6, you start to really have to reach. And even when you come up with one, you have to think for a second about, oh, does that really stand up in terms of being well acted, well scripted, decent characters? You know, it starts to take a while, because you do have to balance that out. You have to find a way to work that in there when you know what everybody is actually already going to be going to this movie just hoping to see, and you're trying to kind of build the medicine in there, but not so much so that it overpowers the spoonful of sugar.
So we're running low on time. I know you got a hard out shortly. But we'd be remiss without talking about the late Tiny Lister Jr.
Oh, God.
They brought him in to be somebody... So here's the thing. I've been talking a lot about action movies as part of this conversation. The other thing people looked at, and the other thing that informs the production of this movie, is Rocky III. They all watched Rocky III and was like, okay, what if we took Rocky III and, like, average Stallone-Schwarzenegger action movie and mushed them together? Okay, great. Then who do we need for a bad guy? Angry Black Man. Got it.
Oh, fuck.
They absolutely were channeling Clever Lang for Zeus, but they needed him to be, like, all professional wrestlery and over the top. I mean, he has the perfect look for it. He's great. And, you know, and then because Vince McMahon can't leave fucking well enough alone, they have to do, you know, they have to actually bring Tiny Lister in as a wrestler for, you know, for a spell. You know, where they run the angle with him, Savage, and Hogan, and which ends with No Holds Barred, the match, the movie, which just saying that out loud gives me a fucking headache. Leave it alone, Vince. It's already dead. No, there's still I can still milk this. Oh, God. Okay, Vince. Speaking of Spectre, you people. Anyway. So, yeah, Tiny Lister, I mean, in his unibrow, his glorious unibrow in this movie, they were like, you're Mr. T, but you're Mr. T, but could you be more of a bear? What if we put Mr. T and a bear together? Could you do that? And Tiny Lister was like, if the pay's good enough. And then he did it, and it was fine. You know, Tiny Lister Jr. plays a great bear cross with Mr. T.
Which, you know, one of the things that we would find out about Tiny so much later in his career is Zeus could not have been much further removed from who he actually was.
Yeah.
He was actually, by the accounts of virtually everyone who worked with him, from Hogan down to Ice Cube, were like, he was the nicest guy, funniest guy, educated, had a pretty successful collegiate athletic career, one of my favorite descriptions was Cube called him America's favorite bully. He said America's favorite bully was a born entertainer who would pop into character at the drop of a hat, terrifying people on and off camera, followed by a big smile and laugh.
I'm going to throw something at you. I'm going to throw you a bit of trivia, and then we can actually, after this, we can start to wrap up.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm a huge fan of, especially like, mid-70s to through the 80s to maybe early 90s African-American comedians, especially because of where I grew up. And one of those people that I was very familiar with, and I was probably the only white kid who was Robert Townsend. Did you ever...
I love Robert Townsend.
Did you ever see Robert Townsend and his Partners in Crime from 1991?
Mm-mm.
So this was like... I don't know if this led into In Living Color or not, and how much it had to do with the Wayans. I don't remember that much of it. But I do remember it was like a sketch comedy thing that he did. And a lot of like that era's like soon to be famous black comedians were on it, and Tiny Lister does a cameo where like there's a if I remember correctly, it's been years since I've watched this, but like Robert Townsend's like doing a bit about like the women that he's dated, and the, you know, and he's being confronted by them, and you know, and each woman kind of does a spiel, and then they flash and it's Tiny Lister, and he was like, I was there too, Robert. Like,
Now, wait a second. Would you be talking about Townsend Television, perhaps?
Maybe. Yeah. Okay. Because that's.
I was going to say.
It's 1993.
Yeah, that was my first exposure to Robert Townsend was Townsend Television.
Okay. Yeah. This precedes that. This is 1991.
Oh.
But I remember watching it vividly as a kid, and because I'll tell you what, because he references Hollywood Shuffle from '87 a lot. How like that opened a lot of doors for him and all this other stuff. And he referenced it all throughout the show. And there's not a lot that I remember from Robert Townsend and his Partners in Crime. Now I want to go find it and watch it. But I'll never forget the Tiny Lister thing, because for whatever reason, I thought that was hilarious.
Okay, we may now... If you find it, we may have to do a whole separate episode dedicated to it, because now I kind of want to see this too.
Yeah, if I find it, I'll send you the link.
I want to see this glorious precursor to In Living Color and Chappelle's Show.
Yeah. It if not directly, at least in spirit, it definitely is a precursor to those. But yeah, man, Tiny Lister Jr., as you were saying, just to sort of finish up on him and the movie as a whole, he played heavy because of his look, but he was absolutely a hilarious guy, and for all accounts, like, he was a good dude.
Let's face it, I don't think it's an exaggeration at all to say that he absolutely makes this movie.
Oh, sure.
Which makes sense because at times one of the great knocks on Hogan was there were a lot of times when Hogan was only as good as his dance partner.
Yeah.
And he
is definitely best in collaboration, Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, absolutely. He did not have the broomstick gift that Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Ric Flair and Mr. Perfect and the like all had as an actor or as a wrestler. And man, it really sometimes takes a smart, thoughtful, really aware performer to play dumb really, really well. historically, I mean, you know, anybody can get in front of a camera and just absolutely wild out, just let the manic energy fly. But the really great ones, more often than not, you find out are tremendously intuitive, smart, really kind people. And when you realize kind of what everybody's impression of him was, it just makes you watch this all the more and just be all the more impressed that he's able to get so much out of uttering, I think, maybe a half dozen actual human English words the entire movie.
Wow. July 7th, 1990, Zeus fought Abdullah the Butcher in a double countout at a World Wrestling Council show in Puerto Rico.
Okay, I didn't know about that.
I did not either, but Wikipedia is a hell of a thing.
Oh, God.
That is fantastic. All right, look, this is one of those things where if you're not a wrestling fan, this is not worth watching. It really isn't. It's one of those things where here's what I'll say about it. This is one of those weird, at least for me, films where it's like, only wrestling fans should watch this movie because only wrestling fans can make fun of this movie. This is ours, and I don't say that about anything, but this is one of those rare gems that belongs to wrestling fans. Nobody else is going to get it, and anyone else that sees it and makes fun of it is making fun of it because it's such a garbage movie without recognizing the charm it holds. And it holds that charm because of its appeal to wrestling fans, if for no other reason than nostalgia. Mm-hmm. You know, for those of us who grew up with Hulk Hogan, for those of us who grew up in that era, this is just unadulterated candy fun, and it should be appreciated on that level. And if you don't have that going into it and you just watch it the same way you would watch a Sharknado kind of a movie, you know, Zootarium or whatever the fuck it's called, you're not going to get it, and it's just going to be like, oh, this is a garbage movie with bad actors. You've then missed the point. Mm-hmm. And if we had done a standard prosecution defense of it, that would have been my defense, basically, is that this, once you get past the fact that it's not a well-made movie and just appreciated it on its charm and its earnest, it's a fun experience. And look, there are movies you watch for the emotion, there are movies you watch for the film craft, and then there are movies you watch because movies are meant to be entertaining. Not everything needs to check the box that challenges you intellectually. And I've said this before, and for most people, they don't want to be challenged intellectually. I guarantee you there are people who would watch this that would be just as entertained by this as they would by something that's actually made well, because they're not thinking about it and they just wanted to kill 90 minutes and not have to think about the world. Mm-hmm. I'll give you the last word and we'll get out of here.
Just, by all means, if you can find it, watch it, appreciate that it's a product of its time, and remember that there was a point in human history when Vincent Kennedy McMahon and Terry Bollea legitimately probably thought this was going to launch Hulk Hogan into the next echelon of action stars.
Cognitive dissonance in wrestling is real.
God, ain't that the truth.
All right, and speaking of cognitive dissonance, let's talk about what we're doing next on the Rad Legion Broadcasting Network. Today was the 5-year anniversary of the release of Surgical Meth Machine's self-titled album, and we actually reviewed that when it came out. That launched an entire series of inside jokes between me and Jesse where we would yell unlistenable at an album and then scream, Nickelback! That's where all that came from. So I released from the archives our review of said Surgical Meth Machine, and that's up on the feed right now. We started our WrestleMania celebration week with Invasion from Planet WrestleTopia in defense of The Ultimate Warrior, another archive show. Our review of NXT Stand and Deliver and a moment on NXT UK Prelude. Our review of WrestleMania. Quick announcement about that, which I have to work on after we're done here. Chris Bailey was not able to make the WrestleMania show, but you can't keep a good Canadian down. So he actually sent me audio of him reviewing WrestleMania by himself because he wasn't going to stand for not being on the show. So I will be posting an addendum to our WrestleMania review for Chris Bailey because he's a good dude and I'm a good dude and we're just good.
What a trooper.
That's right. Pat and I kicked off a new show, speaking of Chris Bailey, who will be joining us next month when we talk about WrestleMania 2. We spent almost 2 hours discussing the history and the event itself, WrestleMania. And we will be doing that every so often over the course of the next year, reviewing each WrestleMania in succession. Jesse released an Unspoken Issues, June 2099. Alexis, Haina, and I tackled the book and the television show in two separate podcasts for Resident Alien. Tomorrow, it's Flashback Friday. We are releasing what was once known as the 411 Summer Blockbuster Series and has been rechristened Damn You Hollywood. This is an oldie but a goodie from me and Jeff Harris. It is Star Trek Into Darkness. Saturday is another syndicated source material, speaking of what was once old is now new again. It is the 97th time we're going to release The Killing Joke, only this time it's edited. So... and in theory, Chris Bailey and I are going to do commentary for Jake Paul versus Ben Askren. So that'll be fun. So you can look for all of that. Last week was all of our Godzilla and King Kong stuff. That's in the archives for you to check out. Plus, another oldie but a goodie, our Man of Steel review, because hashtag restore the Snyderverse, Sean. Restore it. We need it.
No.
Release the air cut. Release the Snyder cut. Release the Kraken. All right. Sorry, I'm on drugs. Speaking of drugs, your plug, sir.
Snyderverse was a fucking mistake. Fight me.
Shut up. We're doing hashtags to push the network, okay?
Follow me on Twitter at Cobra Codex. Tomorrow night, April 16th, 10 p.m. Central Time, I'm going to be on twitch.tv/Cobra Codex. I haven't decided what I'm playing. I'm thinking we're probably going to be trying to wrap up the Bioshock run that I've been on lately, and then moving into some Injustice 2, maybe some Apex Legends. Never know what you're going to get in my channel, but I'm now that things are kind of settling down a little bit at home, I've got my full-time job. I've kind of patched a few holes in the dike here and there. I'm looking to get back into a steady streaming schedule. So please join me on April 16th for some late night fun and shenanigans, and again for even more late night shenanigans and monkey shines and balderdash and all kinds of other fun words to say, on April 17th, where we are probably going to be finishing up Bioshock 2, starting Bioshock Infinite.
Hey, the next time we're doing an on trial, and I promise we'll get back to our usually scheduled format. Sean and I will be putting the 1995 Mortal Kombat on trial, and that is April 29th. I will be prosecuting. Sean will be defending the Mortal Kombat from 1995. Can't wait. Can you wait? I can't wait.
Not at all. Chomping at the bit.
All right, folks. Thank you for joining us here on trial. I think we've decided plea bargain, community service, and probation. Be well, be safe, and behave.